It's TechBiter Worldwide. I'm Bill Blinn with an hour's worth of technology news in about 20 minutes. That's because we leave out the sports, most of the jingles, the weather, and the commercials.
Podcast number 362 for September 29th, 2013. This week, your internet service provider includes a DNS server, but you might want to ignore it. Adobe competes with Adobe, and it seems everyone wins. In short circuits, new tablets from Microsoft and Amazon. Remember Mist? 9 million iPhones in 2 days, and fraudsters continue to find a way around spam filters. Recently, when the Wi-Fi part of our router stopped working, I had to purchase another router. I ended up with a Linksys EA6500, which is one of the company's newer routers. Figuring out how to set up open DNS for the router turned out to be harder than it should have been. Part of that was my fault. Starting with the assumption that specifying DNS servers would be on the connectivity page, I went there first. The basic and internet tabs provided no joy, but I figured I'd find what I was looking for on the local network tab. I didn't. That's the my fault part. The entry is actually there. It's on the page, but, you know, medium gray text on a light gray background isn't really very easy to read. I looked right over the two entries for Static DNS 1 and Static DNS 2. And because this is one of Linksys's new routers, the procedures described and illustrated on the company's website didn't match what was on my screen. Eventually, I looked a little closer, found what I was looking for, and added the DNS entries. To confirm the change, I just opened a command window and ran ipconfig/all. Among the information that this command returns are the IP addresses of any DNS servers that you're using. So what is a domain name service server? The DNS server translates human-readable web addresses like techbiter.com into an IP address. In the case of TechBiter, it's 67.222.41.89. Think of it kind of like a phone number. You could enter that number whenever you want to visit the site, but most people find it a lot easier to remember TechBiter than 67.222.41.89. DNS is a critical part of the internet, and one that's largely invisible. Your internet service providers, such as Wide Open West or Time Warner or Comcast, provide their own DNS servers, and those are what you're using unless you've done something to change them. So if the ISP provides the service, why change? OpenDNS offers services that your ISP probably doesn't, such as misspelling correction, phishing protection, and content filtering, if you choose to use it. The OpenDNS global network processes about 45 billion DNS queries every day from 50 million active users connected to the service through 19 data centers around the world. You'll find information on the TechBiter Worldwide website about the IP addresses to use if you want to use OpenDNS as your DNS service. All you have to do is add the numbers to your router's configuration, and all computers on your network will use OpenDNS. Now, if you have just one computer and no router, you'll have to make the change on the computer, and it's a little more complicated when you do it that way. You have to start with the control panel and work your way down through Network Sharing Center to Network Adapter Properties, and then select the IP4 entry, right-click it to choose Properties, select Use the following DNS server addresses, and then finally fill in the OpenDNS settings. It's almost worth buying a router, even if you only have one computer, just to avoid that. Unlike most ISP's DNS servers, OpenDNS blocks phishing websites. It uses data from FishTank. It also corrects many typing errors that could land your browser on a poisoned website. Typing goggle.com, G-O-G-L-E, instead of google.com, for example, could do that. In this case, OpenDNS recognizes what you mean and opens Google's main page automatically. The service is free, so you're probably wondering how this can happen. Well, the answer is this. If you type a domain name that isn't valid and isn't one that OpenDNS's spelling correction can fix, you'll be shown a search page based on the faulty URL. OpenDNS is paid for the ads that are served there. OpenDNS is probably faster than your ISP's DNS server, possibly more up-to-date, It offers protective features your ISP doesn't. It corrects typos. And it serves ads only when you type in a URL that it can't recognize. Oh, and the ads you see? Those will probably show you the URL that you really did want. So what's not to like? To learn more about OpenDNS, you can visit the website, and you'll find a link on the TechBiter Worldwide website. Sometimes I think that Adobe keeps its software engineers on their toes by constantly pushing features from the high-end Photoshop and Premiere applications down to Photoshop Elements and Premiere Elements. That forces the developers to create new features that can be added to the top-line applications. But it also means that people who want to edit photos or videos at home and without learning how to use astonishingly complex applications and without paying a lot of money for those astonishingly complex applications can do so. This week, Adobe released version 12 of the Elements applications, and they are now available in stores, either as individual applications or as a package. Either way, you also receive the Elements Organizer application, which reminds me a lot of Lightroom's Library View. Bob Gager, the group product manager for Adobe Elements, says the primary difference between the astonishingly complex applications that professionals use and Elements is that the astonishingly complex part is eliminated.
The Elements products are built from our pro products. So Photoshop Elements is built from Photoshop. Premiere Elements is built from Premiere Pro. But what we do is take the features and the technologies of those products that are designed for a pro audience and bring them to life in a way that's relevant for consumers. So photo editing and video editing, for a different set of folks, primarily folks who are doing it more as a hobby, either just as a casual hobby or advanced hobbyist, we sometimes call them. But what they really appreciate is all of the power of our Pro Tools, but them being brought to life in a way that's easier to use, easier to understand, because these folks aren't using these tools day in and day out to accomplish their job. They're using them less frequently to work with their own personal photos and videos.
The new version of the Elements Organizer reminds me a lot of what you see in Lightroom, and it's available with both Photoshop Elements and Premiere Elements, as it always has been.
We have two products, Photoshop Elements, Premiere Elements, but there are actually three different applications. The Elements Organizer ships with both Photoshop Elements and Premiere Elements, and that's really the hub of the products where you manage both photos and videos, collect them together in various ways, search, sort, find, all those kind of management activities that you do with your media.
The newest feature in the Organizer aims to make it easier to use your images and videos on mobile devices.
There's a big trend towards more mobile photo taking and video capturing. At this point, most folks have a camera phone in their purse or pocket that's able to take great pictures, able to take great video, and we're finding that a lot of Elements users are starting to have that be their capture device of choice. They're still using a more sophisticated camera for planned events, but for more spontaneous type of photo and video taking activities, it's that camera phone that they're starting to use. And what we've heard from them in talking about this more mobile workflow around their photos and videos is they're still having, you know, trouble getting the photos and videos off of their phone onto their PC into Elements where they actually do their editing. They still want to use their desktop software to do really interesting, compelling, higher-powered editing activities. So the way we've solved that problem is to do it in a very seamless way inside the Elements Organizer. On the left-hand side of the Elements Organizer is our Albums panel. So albums aren't new to Elements. Just as a quick refresher, albums are a way for you to collect together a group of photos and videos that are related to each other in some way. And so this is completely free form. You can create any albums you want. You can rearrange them, all kinds of good stuff. So what we've done in this new release is add this new section called mobile albums. And mobile albums work exactly as regular albums work, right? They are a collection of photos and videos that are related to each other in some way. And the primary difference between these mobile albums is that they also have a characteristic that they're available to me on my mobile devices. So if I wanted to, say, take this album of some beach photos and have that available on my phone or my tablet, I just drag it from my local albums down into my mobile albums, and it gets moved down there. This collection of photos is available to me wherever I am, as long as I have my phone or my tablet. And this is by the new connection that we have in the Elements Organizer to Adobe Revel. So Adobe Revel is the app that runs on those devices, and access to Adobe Revel from my desktop is through this mobile albums feature of Elements. If I switch over to the album view inside Revel, you can see the same five albums, including that one that I just dragged in there, are available to me here over on my phone. Any changes I made, any photos that I add, any activity that I do is available to me on both sides.
Well, this kind of application tends to make me just a little bit nervous because changes made on different devices can be lost if the synchronization fails or a modified image can overwrite the original. Although either of those would be a very bad thing, Adobe has done a lot to protect users.
We save it in what we call a version set. The original image in the version set is preserved, so we haven't overwritten your original file, so if you ever want to get back to it, you don't have to worry about losing it just because you've been editing it. And as you would expect, since this edited version of this Alyssa shot is in the Alyssa album, which is part of my old mobile albums, if I move my phone back over so you can see it, now you can see here is that shot we just edited. Let me grab my phone and tap on that. You can see that edit that I did on my desktop has found its way back to my phone. So whether I've got my phone with me in a coffee shop or my tablet with me on the couch at home, I can enjoy those same set of photos wherever I am. I don't have to have my laptop with me in order to be able to get to the photos that are in my Elements Organizer catalog.
Sharing photographs and videos is important. Instead of just printing photos and mailing them, that's the really old way of doing it, or attaching them to an email and sending them that way, now you can just make them available to your friends online. And everything that works with photos also works with videos.
So if I want to share to Facebook, I can still share to Facebook or Flickr or YouTube or Vimeo. Brand new this year in Elements 12 is Twitter. So that's a new sharing service that we've integrated in. But what I can also do now is share any of these mobile albums out with friends and family. And the way I do that is just select one of them. I can copy this link and then open up an email browser and maybe send an email, paste the link in. She could read my email, click on the link. But when she clicks on the link, the web browser will open, take her directly to this album of pictures of my cat. And then she can enjoy that without having to log in, without having to create an account, any of those barriers that might prevent her from enjoying my photos.
With Elements 12, you can now have a shared library. What's that? Gager is a coach when he's not working at Adobe, and he explains how other parents can collaborate to share photos of their children.
With this feature that we call a shared library, I can collaborate with other parents on the team around the photos and videos that are being taken. So it's as simple as creating the library, typing in the email address of any other parent on the team that I would like to have access to the shared library, and they will get an email invitation. They can click on the link. They can load Adobe Revel on any of their devices. There's even an Adobe Revel app that runs on your desktop. Or if they happen to be an Elements user, of course, they would have access to it through Elements. But what this enables now is for all of us to be able to submit photos and videos into this shared library and get access to them. So anything I add, everybody who's collaborating with me can see. Anything anybody else adds, all of the collaborators, including me, can see. We can all do some editing. We can all do some organizing. And we can all take advantage of all of that work that each of us are doing as a collaborative group around a common common set of photos and videos.
Guided edits allow the application to teach users how to use the application. This has been one of the most impressive parts of the Elements package.
Guided edits are a really cool feature in the product where we've essentially built in tutorials to help a more novice user be successful in being more creative with their photos. And so there are a whole bunch of these. The notion of guided edits isn't new to version 12, but since these are really popular with our users, we continue with each release to add to the library of guided edits. So there are three new ones this year. Zoom Burst, hard enough to do if your subject's standing still. It's impossible to do if you have an action shot, such as the surfer that I took down in La Jolla last year. We have a new one that we call Puzzle Effect. Puzzle Effect lets me take an image and turn it into a jigsaw puzzle. The third guided edit new this year is Restore Old Photo. And you can see we've brought to life in this guided edit a series of steps and all the right tools that you would need to restore an old photo.
Guided edits are an important part of Premiere Elements, too.
Just like in Photoshop Elements, we've added a bunch of guided edits that help people who are new to video editing become successful with maybe some more advanced techniques that might just be out of their reach. So we've got a whole series of these everywhere from just simply getting started, which is a guided edit that helps you understand how to use Premiere Elements, on through things like trimming frames or adding transitions or scoring your movie or titles and narrations and pictures in picture, right? An ever-increasing set of guided edits that help you do those cool video editing activities that you might want to do, but you really have no idea how to do.
Previous versions of the Elements application had smart corrections, but now they're even smarter. Smart Tone is one of the new ones.
Yeah, Smart Tone algorithms will analyze my photo, figure out a bunch of characteristics about it, bounce it against a database of corrections that are appropriate for that kind of photo, and it has improved my photo just to make it look better. But of course, what's better to me may be slightly different than what's better to you, right? The algorithm corrects it and makes it better in the eyes of the engineer who wrote the algorithm and the photographers who helped refine how it works. But maybe I like my photos corrected slightly differently. So what we've done in Elements 12 is we give you the original correction, but then four extremes of the same algorithm in the thumbnails in the four corners. And then a joystick right here in the center where I can drag it around. If I drag it all the way to the corner, I get that extreme or that extreme or that extreme or that one. But the really cool thing is that I can blend together any amount of any of those four extreme corrections to make this photo look like I like it to look. I tend to like a little brighter, a little higher contrast photos. Maybe you like a little darker, a little higher contrast photos, or maybe a little darker, a little lower contrast. The point is that you can fine-tune the correction algorithm to match your personal preferences. And then the second notch that we kicked it up, which is really the coolest one, is that when I click OK, Photoshop Elements will actually remember the tweaking that I did after the fact and learn from my personal preferences and the adjustments that I make. So the next time I use Auto Smart Tone, it won't correct it as the engineer who wrote the code thought it should be corrected. It'll actually start there, but then it'll layer on my personal preferences from previous tweaking that I've done and automatically correct it to my personal preferences. It actually learns from how I use the feature such that next time I use it, I don't actually have to fine-tune it. It's already corrected the way I want it. And so the more I use this feature, the better it does at learning, you know, how I like my photos, and the better it does at just automatically making them perfect in my eyes.
Group Product Manager for Adobe Elements, Bob Gager, notes that Adobe Revel is free. Revel lets you import as many photos as you want for the first 30 days for sharing. After that, you can import up to 50 photos every month. If you take a lot of photos, Revel Premium, which lets you import as many photos as you want, costs $6 a month. If you like sharing your photographs and you want them to be available on all of your computers and handheld devices, this would be a good choice. A couple of improvements caught my eye in Photoshop Elements. They include Straighten, which now has an autofill edges option that uses content-aware fill. Depending on the image involved, this will either work perfectly or it'll be a disaster. Not too much in between. If the image edge has a fairly consistent content, such as sky or grass, it'll probably work really well. But if there's a lot of complex content out near an edge, you'll probably need to turn the feature off. You might be wondering why straightening an image would require content-aware fill. Picture this, so to speak. Take a photograph out of its frame and rotate either the frame or the picture slightly. An application straightens an image by rotating it. Now that you've got the picture and the frame, and one of them is rotated, note that the frame cuts off part of the picture. If you rotated the picture counterclockwise, the upper right and lower left corners will be trimmed. The other corners, upper left and lower right in this case, will be empty. Those empty areas are where content-aware fill would be needed. Adobe Lightroom includes an option that can automatically crop away the blank area, but doing that sometimes creates havoc with the image itself. A second big improvement is a variant of red-eye correction. When people tried to use this with pets in earlier versions, they found that it didn't work. That's because dog and cat eyes don't reflect red the way human eyes do. The new pet eye option of the red-eye correction tool takes care of it. And for videographers, Premiere Elements adds 4 new film looks. There are more than 250 sound effects that can be added to videos, along with more than 50 music tracks. I would say that the music tracks are looped, but actually the technology is better than just standard looping. Specify how long the music track needs to be, and Premiere Elements will work out how to extend the music track so that it works properly. Bottom line, for cats, Adobe Elements is a bargain for those who value ease of use. Every version of Elements gets better because more high-end features are included, and included in a way that makes them easy to use. For more information, see the Adobe Elements website. You'll find a link on the TechBiter Worldwide website. In short circuits, it's been a week of tablets, and this week on consecutive days, Microsoft and Amazon announced new tablets. For Microsoft, it was the next version of the Surface that, despite good reviews and powerful features, hasn't sold very well. For Amazon, an updated Kindle Fire. The second-generation Surface tablet offers few enhancements on the outside, but users will find that Surface 2 is faster, has extended battery life, and presents sharper screen images. Microsoft seems to be willing to accept slow sales for now as it tries to build devices that will compete with Apple's iPad. The competition is certain to increase with Microsoft's acquisition of Nokia's handset and services business. As a result of that acquisition, Microsoft adds thousands of employees who know a lot about designing and manufacturing mobile devices. So far, though, the Surface can't even remotely be considered a success. Microsoft took a $900 million accounting charge last quarter because of weak sales and then dropped the price of the tablets. Total Surface sales for the fiscal year were about $853 million compared to iPad sales of more than $33 billion. But Microsoft is continuing to plan for the future. They've got devices on the drawing board that won't go on sale until late in 2015. Microsoft has no plans to offer a smaller version of the Surface, even though smaller devices from Apple, like the iPad Mini, and from manufacturers of Android systems like Google's Nexus 7 are selling well. In Apple's case, the Mini, though, is probably cannibalizing sales of full-size tablets, so Microsoft is wise to avoid splitting development between two sizes, at least for now. As for Amazon, the new Kindle Fire is said to be lighter, faster, and less expensive. This is the first update to the system since it was introduced 2 years ago. Specifically, the Kindle Fire HDX will weigh only about 2/3 of what the original model weighed, and it'll come with both a faster processor and faster memory. Yes, memory does have a speed. The nearly 9-inch screen places it somewhere between the 5 and 7-inch tablets and the larger 10 and 11-inch tablets. Amazon says the new model has a better battery life. If the Fire is used only for reading, the battery would run the device for 17 hours. Sales of the Fire, though, are believed to be relatively weak, but Amazon doesn't release information about sales of individual devices. The least expensive new model will sell for just $140. It has been 20 years since a new kind of computer game went on sale. Remember Myst? An article on Grantland discusses the game and how it was supposed to change gaming forever. If you remember the game, or even if you don't, you'll probably find the article to be a worthwhile read. You'll find a link to it on the TechBiter Worldwide website. The game opened to a foggy vista from a dock. In the water, all that was visible of a sunken ship was the masts and a crow's nest. Animated water ebbed and flowed. The landscape was surreal. Two large gears were on top of a distant hill. You could turn and view a full 360-degree scene, but there was nobody there. Eventually, you would find a piece of paper with a note to Catherine. I've left you a message of utmost importance in the forechamber beside the dock. Enter the number of marker switches on this island into the imager to retrieve the message. It was signed Atrus. And the game began. The article by Emily Yoshida reminded me of the game. I'd actually forgotten about it years ago. Myst was designed by brothers Robin and Rand Miller, and it was distributed by Broderbund. Eventually, it was released for most computers and game consoles of the time, Apple, Sega, Microsoft Windows, Atari, PlayStation, Amiga, Nintendo, all the usual suspects. Technically, the game player is the stranger who must explore to seek out clues that will reveal the backstories of various characters. Depending on the player's actions, the game can end in one of several ways. At the time, the CD-ROM format was brand new, and Myst was one of the driving forces that led computer manufacturers to add optical drives to their machines. When Myst was released 20 years ago, the text-based game Zork was still popular, although not as much as it had been in decades before. Zork began on mini-computers before being ported to desktop systems. In fact, it began on mini-computers before desktop systems existed. The first version of Zork was written in 1977 using the MDL programming language on a DEC PDP-10 computer. The authors, Tim Anderson, Mark Blank, Bruce Daniels, and Dave Liebling, were members of the MIT Dynamic Modeling Group. Because Zork was a text-based game, the player could only read about locations and actions. The opening scene, for example, west of house. You're standing in an open field west of a white house with a boarded front door. There is a small mailbox here. I remember typing open mailbox and being told that something was in the mailbox. Later, the player goes into the house and down into a dungeon. Zork was unusual because of very clever writing and programming that was smart enough to understand more than simple commands such as hit troll. Actions could be expanded and combined. You could type hit the troll with the elvish sword and then go north. And the game would do that. As with Acme in Roadrunner cartoons, Froboz Co. International plays an important part in Zork. Well, all right, maybe it's a bit part. Froboz Co. International is a fictional conglomerate. The products from that company are found throughout the Zork trilogy. Games have really changed a lot in 20 years, haven't they? Apple's new iPhone, 5S and 5C models went on sale last weekend, and all available models were sold. That would be 9 million phones. The sales were almost double what Apple had recorded when any previous version was released. 9 million phones in 2 days. Last year's first weekend of sales for the iPhone 5 ended with sales of about 5 million phones. This year was different in a couple of ways. First, it was the first time in iPhone's history that Apple put two new models on sale instead of just one. And the phones went on sale internationally, including in China, not just in the United States. But sales were still better than expected. Analysts had expected sales in the 5 to 8 million range. Apple didn't say exactly how many of each model were sold, but the more expensive model seemed to be the better seller. Prior to the weekend, Apple had accepted online orders for the less expensive 5C, but not for the 5S. Seeing more spam these days? In the past week, I've received hundreds of spams that have somehow slipped through all of my defenses. Offers for low mortgage rates, messages that tell me I'll forfeit my $15,000 mortgage credit if I don't reply, messages that tell me I can buy a new iPhone at 90% off retail price. One would have to be an idiot to fall for any of these, but there seems to be no shortage of idiots. What's more concerning to me is how these messages sailed right through my defense system. I'm not an idiot, or so I like to think, and the messages are obvious frauds, but why did they show up in my inbox? Spam filters do work, but the creeps find ways around them. One problem with spam filters is that they are so simplified that legitimate emails can be identified as spam. Most of what ends up in the junk folder is spam, but I still need to check each message to ensure that I don't allow the deletion of something that I really want to read. Spam that's written in Chinese seems to be sneaking through, too. I don't read Chinese, but thanks to Google, I see that somebody in China would like to provide management training skills to me. Increases and decreases in spam levels are natural. The spammers devise a way to avoid spam filters, and then the anti-spam people develop a method that catches the new spams. Kind of reminds me of the ongoing battles between police agencies that buy radar devices to catch speeders, and speeders who buy radar detectors, often made by the same companies that make the radar devices the police use, to evade the police radar. The manufacturers cash in from both sides of that battle. When it comes to spam, though, the good guys and the bad guys are definitely on opposite sides, and I expect the volume of spam will drop back to normal in a few days once the good guys figure out what the bad guys are doing. If not, I guess I'll have to search out some new ways to defeat spam on my own. I'll let you know what happens, and let me know what your spam levels are like right now. Thanks for listening to TechBiter Worldwide, the weekly podcast with an hour's worth of technology news in about 20 minutes. All music on TechBiter Worldwide is licensed under the Creative Commons, and information about performers is on the website, www.techbiter.com. I'm Bill Blinn, and if you'd like, you can also send me a message from the website. Thanks for listening. I look forward to talking with you again in a week.